This is Higher Ed Heroes with Dr. Sebastian Kempf and Dr. Alistair Stark.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to a second season of Higher Ed Heroes.
Yay!
My name is Alistair Stark, and I'm joined with the indefatigable Sebastian Kempf. This is our first episode in our second series, and as you can hopefully tell, we are very excited to be back and to be talking all things higher education.
Al, nice to see you back here in the studio. It's funny that we have had a full first season done already, because when we look back, right, it all started off with us occasionally sitting outside our building on a bench over lunch. You have your sandwich, I have my coffee. Something never changes. We had these great, very basic conversations about, hey, what do you do in your classroom? Oh, I've got an idea. How could this work? And that was sort of what led us, what we found was really inspiring and really something that we could work with and that actually helped us become better teachers in the end.
Yes, who would have thought a podcast was born out of a sandwich? But it really was. And our intention was to replicate those conversations that we had outside, to try and replicate conversations which created little improvements in our classrooms and led to experiments that we thought had enhanced our teaching and improved the students' experience. And we wanted to share those conversations with our colleagues.
It was actually just the idea of experimenting with the format of a podcast. And I think what certainly took me by surprise is how well it actually was received. And I think the feedback that we got from you guys, that we got from colleagues, was very encouraging. And most stunning of all of this was how this podcast actually started traveling around the world. So we had it being downloaded by over 2,000 people from over 47 different countries. And Al, you were so thrilled. I remember you were nearly dancing in your office when you heard that someone from, you know, people in Kazakhstan and Nepal were even listening to that.
I am incredibly proud of our two listeners in Kazakhstan and Nepal. And we are extremely thankful for all of our listeners, and especially for those people who actually tried out what they heard, who took the plunge and were brave enough to experiment in their classrooms as a consequence. And we really had lots of fun doing that, and we really appreciated the fact that people listened and sometimes acted on what they heard. So we've decided to continue for a second season.
And so, you know, in preparation for this second season, we've been obviously thinking about what it is that we're going to retain from what we did. And so what we're clearly going to keep is the kind of down-to-earth, chat-like discussions. We also decided, very importantly, to keep our buzzer.
No.
It's the only thing that gives me power.
And of course, the buzzer, besides giving L power, is also there to remind us to avoid jargon, to keep things intelligible to everyone. And the last thing we decided that we want to keep for sure is to keep the episodes around a 20-minute mark. That seemed to be a really good time period for the listeners here.
But we want to add some elements in to this new season, so we're going to branch out a little bit further. So we've lined up guests not just from within our faculty this time, the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences at the University of Queensland. We will have some guests from that faculty. But we've also invited colleagues from across universities, across Australia, across the world, outside of our own discipline, outside of our own practice. And we want to hear their experiments and their practices and bring it into our faculty.
The big difference between the time when we recorded the first season and now is that we're all stuck in this COVID lockdown, semi-lockdown type of world. And it has forced, I think, most of us, if not all of us, to go into some form of online teaching mode and to have to adjust. And I think, you know, the question that has been on everyone's mind is whether and how we can actually replicate those pedagogical gems, those aspects that make our classroom learning unique in times of Zoom interaction and the struggle and the endless struggle of keeping students focused and interacting. How, by the way, has that been for you, Al?
Do we get to say
no
when we use the phrase online learning? Or maybe we should go when we say Zoom. Maybe we should have a Zoom penalty. How's COVID been for my teaching? I was just putting in place some of the gimmicks we learned from season one. I had stolen Linda Shevler's great idea to use students and put them on a spectrum in the classroom physically. and I had just put 200 students on a spectrum around a variety of questions on climate change, and I was feeling very pleased with myself, and I was looking forward to a semester of stealing these ideas and implementing them, when all that was taken away. But there's still been some good gimmicks to come through the online space, if I could use that phrase instead of online learning. One of the things I've quite enjoyed doing is using Padlets. I think Padlets have given me the opportunity to add visuals into the instructions for students. I've quite enjoyed that. It made me feel less technologically phobic than I have been. And the other little gimmick that I've liked to do is at the start of the online tutorial is encourage students to put their pets in front of the camera. And because students haven't always got a pet, I get them to put a teddy bear. And if they don't have a teddy bear, I get them to use a sock as a puppet to say hello. And it encourages them to put on their camera and to speak to each other and to laugh and to realise that you can be a human being even if it's just via Zoom. I think there are little gimmicks that we can still do even in these times, but we want to be optimistic, don't we? And we want to think about classrooms reopening.
I mean, I remember at some point that we had been talking and you felt that teaching is not fun in these COVID times. And we had these conversations when we not just at the moment in March had to all flick from an existing course into online learning, but when we actually had to prepare for the next semester and we kind of had to not just do emergency measures, but think more creatively and systematically around teaching, where, you know, the big question has always been, do you strip unconventional courses out of their unconventional elements and go down to just sort of a lecture and online tute thing? Or do you actually try to turn this into some form of a meaningful interactive learning? And we had like different ideas around that. And I decided in one of my very unconventional courses to actually keep the unconventional element, keep the interaction, even if it means for 77 students meeting for 3 hours on Zoom to do really practical activities. And in a way, it was a decision to go for broke. I wasn't sure. In fact, I was sleeping very, very little before the first of these 3 hour sessions that happened several times a semester. But the interesting thing for me was that it works. Mm. I'm very, very surprised, very positively surprised, but like by making them do little things, that whole variety of different activities individually, in teams, in plenary, to make them watch something, read something, to kind of build it like a kind of practice session in a gym where they do different activities with lots of breaks, that seem to have worked. But it's just a lot of work to actually implement that.
But that's why I like and have always liked our sandwich conversations, because you are much braver than me. And whereas I don't mind putting a dog in front of a camera for a cheap laugh, you always go the extra mile and do the extra effort. And when I watch what you do, I always get encouraged to take a risk, because you're always taking much more. And that's part of these conversations that I really enjoy.
Now, one of the things that we decided very deliberately for this second season is to not make it COVID-focused. We've just talked about our experience with COVID, and of course that's on everyone's mind. But for us, it's very clear that A, it is limited what we can do in this format. B, that for us, the kind of big inspiring thing still comes from talking to people what they do in their classroom that really excites them, also in the hope and in the knowledge that at some point we'll be returning to the classroom in its personal old style form.
Mm. And I think we also believe, don't we, that by talking about teaching as it was pre-pandemic and talking about what inspires us and thinking about those classroom practices, some of that can be transferred over. But I think it's really important that we optimistically look to the future. We have to think beyond the pandemic. We have to be forward-looking and think about what we're going to do when we get back to our classrooms, even if they're going to be different spaces. And actually, at this point in time, we have some space to think about planning for the future and for those classrooms.
Can also come in here, because what I found really interesting talking to obviously lots of colleagues about how do you teach now under COVID in an online Zoom type format. And I always felt that if you just focus on like, okay, this is all electronically and you know, you're very limited in your creativity. And I actually felt re-listening some of our previous episodes or talking to people about just general teaching practice and what they do, that's really inspiring. And if you want to have creativity and inspiration, even in the context of a COVID-type classroom setting, then I think it's really important to not just confine yourself to what do people now do at times of COVID, but like what do generally people do as great practice?
So it's Billy Connolly versus Werner Herzog for another season.
That's
right. Are we going to talk about a couple of teaching practices that we both love?
Yeah, I think so. And I think you would be well placed to kick this off, Al.
Thank you very much, Werner. So I want to talk about an exercise which is based around failure. Often when we create classroom experiences, we want to have students do certain things. For the lesson to be successful, we need students to react to prompts, to listen to what we instruct them to do, and to act in certain ways. But in at least one of my weeks, you get to completely fail, and the failure is where the lesson sits. And so this relates to a citizen's jury simulation. And actually, I do a big simulation here across 4 weeks, but I also do it in a single tutorial that takes 1 hour. So you can scale it from a small one-hour tutorial right up to a four-week block. So a citizen's jury is basically a public forum which brings citizens together to take a public policy decision. It's based on a theory of deliberative democracy that says through proper rational deliberation, we can get good public policy outcomes. But of course, that's very, very difficult to achieve. So what I do is basically put students into a deliberate space, encourage them to debate and deliberate on a policy topic, and then crucially, I ensure that the deliberation fails. Sometimes it fails on its own. Sometimes I steer the deliberation so that I bring it to a failure. And then I invite the students to reflect on those failings.
And is that, can I come in here? Like the failing, is that sort of, that's very deliberate.
It's deliberate, yeah. It's a wonderful class because you don't have to try. When the lesson comes off the rails, it's a success. So let me tell you, you know, here's the probably familiar three or four things that can ruin a tutorial. One, no one does the reading. Okay, that's great in this one. That's brilliant. No one speaks, or some people speak more than others. Fantastic. Another failure that we can capitalise on. Or you run out of time. Great. Brilliant. That's also good. Or students say things which are really problematic, either in terms of their factual accuracy or even in terms of their moral or ethical dimensions. Fail. Excellent. Because all of these things happen in the real world of a citizen's jury. And all of these things allow us to question the value of deliberative democracy. So what I do is simply give them a question, sit back and watch how they struggle to deliberate and decide on it. And then I get them to reflect on it. And so in the grand four-week simulation, I give them lots of evidence. I've got pre-prepared videos with experts made by professionals. They get all the information that they need, and we run a mock jury that has to come with an outcome, and it slowly falls apart over 3 to 4 weeks. And I get them to keep a diary, a reflective diary, and then at the end they write a reflective essay, and the reflective essay contains their thoughts on what worked, what failed, how that links to the bigger claims about deliberation and deliberative democracy, but also, more importantly, how they would fix those problems. So that's the big one. But then in the one-hour tutorial, I just put a big policy question out and say, OK, let's go through 3 steps to get an outcome here. They never get past step one, which is basically choosing the policy topic to deliberate on. Yeah. Big voices come to the fore. Other people sit quietly and just let other people do the work. If they can't make a decision, I get them to vote their way out, which is a failure of deliberative democracy. And also I subtly steer from the background. I manipulate and get my own way, and I don't tell them that. I reveal that to them later. So after the hour where deliberation doesn't work, I tell them, okay, go away and next week come back with 5 personal points about how you thought you deliberated and whether it was worthwhile. And then we link them to the claims from the literature. So it's a whole classroom designed around failure. And it's fantastic because you don't really have to prepare. It's great. You just go in and watch it all fall apart, and that is the lesson.
I could totally see how you get joy out of that.
you know, you prepare and you prepare, and then you can go into lessons going, God, I hope this works. I hope they've all read, and I hope that I can, you know, carry this off and get to the learning outcome that I want. Whereas with this one, you can go in and go, oh yeah, take as long as you want. Take as long as you want. Oh, you've not read? You've not prepared? Great. So what do you think? Well, okay. Sounds a bit strange. Well, that's a bit of a strange comment. Should that be part of the debate? Okay. Students should be deliberating at university, but they all struggle. So designed to fail. I recommend it.
That's a good slogan.
Only if it's deliberate, though.
Yeah. Yeah, nice. Well, one of the things, you know, talk about, you know, making students read and so on. One of the things I like doing is run practical sessions in my courses where students have to get their hands dirty. It varies from week to week and from course to course. But to give you one example, there's a week where we talk about how the Pentagon for nearly 100 years has had an office in downtown Los Angeles where filmmakers from Hollywood can go and seek Pentagon support for the production of films. Not just war movies, but comedy and sci-fi and now also TV shows. And it's a back and forth of negotiations. Obviously, you know, the Pentagon would only sign up to provide you access to an aircraft carrier if you're a filmmaker, if you're not, don't say anything critical about the military. And they've got certain kind of standards. But you can imagine that this is not necessarily a very transparent process. Mm-hmm. And a lot of speculation, a lot of conspiracy theories have existed around that. But in terms of serious academic writing, there hasn't been much because there hasn't been much evidence until 2 years ago. Two colleagues in the UK and a colleague of mine in the US who I'm working with were successful in bringing through FOIA, Freedom of Information access requests, with the Pentagon's Entertainment Liaison Office, which now for the first time had to hand over its database, or not the entire, but like a large section of its database about the history of its collaboration with Hollywood filmmakers. And so what we now see for the first time is that over 1,000 films, Hollywood blockbuster productions, and over 1,000 TV series and TV shows have been produced in close collaboration with the Pentagon.
Wow.
Which we don't know anything about. But what we now have is, like, you know, the Marvel series, we've got, you know, Pearl Harbor, all these kinds of really big films that you would know about. We have the PDF files. Sometimes, like, if you take the one of Pearl Harbor, it's like 190 pages of PDF in this PDF file about the back and forth of the original negotiations, letters sent, emails responded, the Pentagon saying we have to take these kinds of lines out, or that's still not good enough. And, you know, that goes back and forth over like 3.5 years. And so what I do in this class is actually make 8 of these different PDFs available of different films, 8 different films to the students, and divide them up in teams, and they can really get their hands dirty and look at all of this. So kind of the first time that outside this group of researchers, someone has access to this and they can really see how that works, which, you know, dispels the conspiracy around that sort of stuff, but really allows them to actually do that kind of research, because we are only starting to do that research ourselves. Mm. Right?
What I love about your topic is it's just so appealing. You know, before you even do the hard yards of an assessment, I kind of want to know what's in those files.
Me too.
You know, so question one, did the Pentagon help make Ghostbusters?
I'd need to check through the database. I'm not sure.
Oh, I hope not. I really hope not. That's my favorite movie.
It would ruin the entire day. Your childhood.
And so what's in these PDFs? The PDF is the Pentagon's negotiations with the filmmaker. And the students have this PDF and they're going through to see the interaction.
I forgot the name of the movie now. It's a kind of counter-insurgency, counter-terrorism film, blockbuster one that was set in Colombia with U.S. forces going there, right, to help overthrow and prevent some sort of plot, coup d'etat over there. And in the original script, it portrayed the Colombian state forces in quite a negative, corrupt light. And the Pentagon, you can see this in, like, we have a political interest in not undermining the Colombian government. It would look really bad. It would alienate their military forces if they were portrayed. You have to cut out these kinds of lines, that kind of sequence, that kind of framing, right? But then it's also like the U.S. president would never order a clandestine military intervention into this country. So you cannot actually have that kind of line of thought. It's pretty amazing, yeah. Right? But it goes sometimes also, like, you know, besides these political influences, which is not, can't portray anything politically controversial, you cannot alienate or endanger U.S. recruitment efforts, all that sort of stuff. It's sometimes factual things like, oh, the uniforms that you say they're wearing, they didn't exist back in those days.
Right? And the students love this, obviously.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. You know, and give them choice so they can pick, you know, and it's bound to include a blockbuster film that they have seen.
So here I am just schlepping through a Design to Fail tutorial, and Seb's got the Pentagon on his side. Once again, I feel inferior from this end of the table, Seb.
You don't have to, man. I think, like, I find the kind of setting up in the... I like the way that you pedagogically think through the exercises you do. But, you know, this ultimately is not about us, right? It's about us now meeting in this season with all sorts of interesting colleagues from within UQ, from beyond UQ, beyond Australia, and hopefully give you guys some really inspiring ideas of you know, what you might want to do, whether you're operating in a COVID or non-COVID type of classroom these days.
Mm. And what we do know from our own experiences is that when you take a bit of a risk and you listen and you put in place things that have worked well in other contexts, it can really pay off, as was the case with my experience of implementing Linda's spectrum in the classroom.
Yeah, and of course, you know, you can sign up to our podcast. You can find us on social media. We've got a Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter account. Our podcast is freely available. You can obviously re-listen to the episodes we have from the first season. But of course, you can be looking forward to having a couple of really awesome people and topics now in the new season.
And we really hope you enjoy this second season as we go further and do a little bit more in terms of bringing you those practices. Thanks.